Welcome to Oncology Today, the implications of recent data sets for the current and future management of genitourinary cancers. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love, and for this program, I'm joined by Dr. William Oh from the Yale Cancer Center in New Haven, Connecticut. To begin, Dr. Oh gives a presentation overviewing some of the key data sets and presentations in genitourinary cancers recently, beginning with prostate cancer.
I'm William Oh. I'm the Director of Precision Medicine for the Yale Cancer Center. I'm also the Service Line Medical Director at Smilo Cancer Hospital at Greenwich Hospital. And I'm happy to give an update on several of the key abstracts presented in the last year in GU cancers. So we can start in prostate cancer. This is, of course, a very active time right now. This slide, I think, summarizes the metastatic hormone-sensitive prostate cancer space. And there are actually 10 published prospective randomized controlled trials, and you'll see I'm going to talk about that 11th one, ARANOTE, thrown right at the bottom because it's the most recent. And basically, the summary for MHSPC is that whether it's doublet therapy, ADT versus ADT plus an AR pathway inhibitor, or triplet therapy, which adds chemotherapy, you can see the hazard ratios for overall survival are significantly better if you add a second or third drug. So almost every patient should be getting a second or third and or third drug in the setting of MHSPC. But really, the data at ESMO this year was that this the most recent one, ARANOTE. And of course, this is darolutamide added to ADT in patients with MHSPC. And you can see on the left there, radiographic progression-free survival, significantly better. The hazard ratio is 0.54. You can see secondary endpoints, including time to PSA progression, hazard ratio 0.31, and a PSA of less than 0.2 at any time during treatment. We do know that the nadir PSA is an important biomarker. I use it in my practice all the time. If the patient's PSA doesn't get very low, it always concerns me that there might be some resistance developing that even if the PSA is down, you want to see it get down to really undetectable levels. The interesting thing about darolutamide compared to some of the other ARPs is really its tolerability. And this is some of the data presented around the most common treatment emergent adverse effects. And I call out on the right side here, the TEAEs leading to permanent discontinuation of the study drug was actually less in the darolutamide arm compared to the placebo arm. So you don't see that very often, Neil, right? It suggests that darolutamide is very well tolerated, even though patients are on it longer, and clearly it has a PFS benefit. So the summary here, in MHSPC, darolutamide added to ADT shows a significant PFS benefit. The side effect profile is very favorable. And there are now multiple choices for therapy. I showed it in the first slide. And maybe the most important question that we don't know the answer to is really who should get chemo up front, because there was no study that looked at chemo versus no chemo with the ARPs on board.
So I got to say this, the finding you point out where the placebo group had more treatment discontinuation, that's one of my favorite findings. There was this one, there was a trial in lung cancer where the placebo group had a 25% incidence of autoimmune complications. So that was the other one I really like. But anyhow, before you get off hormone-sensitive metastatic disease, I have to bring up the what seems like the age-old question of chemo or not. And one thing I've been kind of curious about is, do you know about what fraction of men who have hormone-sensitive metastatic disease are just PSMA positive, not positive when they're scanned? You know, they've been followed, they've got a high PSA, and they get picked up with mets on PSMA. Is that a big fraction or very, very small?
I think it depends on when we're scanning them. You mean in the setting of MHSPC, I think we're definitely picking up many more patients who would be negative on a typical bone scan or CAT scan alone. Maybe it's 20, 30, 50%, as high as 50%.
Okay. Yeah, no, I would figure that that would not be uncommon. I mean, like if you look at just hormone-sensitive mets, a bunch of them are going to be de novo. I'm not talking about that. That's a different story. But the other ones, a lot of them have had local therapy, they've been followed, and they get, picked up when their PSA is increasing. So I guess the reason I'm bringing that up is there's all this big argument that I want to get your take on about people with, macro metastatic, whatever you want to call it, positive on scan, about whether to use chemo. But I have another question about these other patients, which is it reasonable to consider, sort of an EMBARK strategy, first of intermittent therapy, and second, even enzalutamide alone, knowing that a lot of the patients in the EMBARK study probably were just like that. I mean, you can't say how many, but probably a lot, right? So I don't know. Is that a crazy thought?
It isn't. And, the EMBARK strategy is very popular with patients because they do not like ADT. So what we're doing is we're taking data and from all of these studies that was not based on PSMA, that was based on traditional imaging like CT and bone scan, and we're applying it to a population where PSMA PET scans have basically taken over initial staging and follow-up. So it's a very good point. And what I've basically done in my practice is think about the biology more than anything. For example, I saw a patient yesterday. He had a single lesion on his PSMA PET scan in his spine, but he had a Gleason 9. He presented de novo, but he had a Gleason 9 cancer with intraductal cancer in every biopsy in his prostate. So he even though he only had one lesion, he has a very bad biology. So he's somebody that I offered chemotherapy to. So I think we have to think a little bit about how we apply this. To your point, though, there are a lot of people where I won't offer chemotherapy because the amount of disease on a PSMA PET scan is maybe too sensitive, and where I might offer enzalutamide monotherapy.
Well, what about the issue of intermittent treatment or not? Because traditionally that wasn't done with metastatic disease, but now it's a different kind of metastatic disease. Will you, if you're going to give them, for example, an AR inhibitor and LHR agonist, will you bring up the idea of doing intermittent, or are you just going to keep them on it?
No, I use intermittent all the time, even in settings where I have to extrapolate. I won't do it until I'm sure that their cancer is in remission, and that always means a PSA that becomes undetectable. But depending on how they tolerate the treatment, it's certainly reasonable to continue them on combination therapy, but I will often offer them a break after several years, particularly if they really dislike the treatment.
That's really a great input. So getting back to the more macro metastatic disease, first thing I have to say is outside of this, when you get into other tumors, this kind of situation, people really put out there, right? The first thing they go is, this is indirect comparison. We don't have direct comparison. People in prostate, they don't do that enough. Everybody sort of knows that we don't have a trial comparing, intensified hormonal therapy plus or minus chemo. But I wish people were made that more clear. But it is indirect, as far as I know. So my question to you is, I hear all the investigators saying, I have a young patient with a lot of disease. I really think about chemo. Is that like more intuition, or is the indirect comparison of the data really dramatic?
I think there's probably a little bit of both. I do think that you have to look at the patient in front of you. I've been on panels where I've asked people how many of their patients with MHSPC do they give chemo to, and it's very wildly variable. There are some institutions where their standard is to give as many people chemo as possible. I'd say in my practice, it's not more than 20 to 30%, mostly because I follow these patients really, really closely, and I'm not 100% convinced that immediate chemo versus very early chemo is that different. So, we work in a space where the clinical trials are done in very specific settings, and our patients don't always fit it neatly into those boxes, as you know, Neil. And for most clinicians, we're trying to balance the risks versus the benefits.
So one final question, which is, you sort of alluded to another potential strategy, which is to start intensified endocrine therapy and see how the patient does. And then if the PSA doesn't drop enough, then do chemo. Is that something you ever do?
It is something that I do, and it is the subject of some ongoing clinical trials.
Really?
I think it's a smart strategy for some patients. I saw another patient recently, a retired physician. He's in his mid-70s, very fit. By some criteria, he had multiple bone mets, lymph node mets, and he should have really been a consideration for chemo. But he really wanted to value his quality of life. So we decided to give him an RP plus ADT, and we're watching him. And if he does not have an adequate response with his PSA, then we will consider adding chemo. But he did not. That was a decision about his quality of life, even though he's very fit, where I would normally recommend chemo. But he, you know, he thought, well, let's wait and see if I don't have an adequate PSA response.
You know, I'm always hesitant to bring up other cancers, and I bring up breast cancer a lot when we talk about prostate. But the reality is a lot of these patients, maybe probably most of them, are getting treated by general medical oncologists, our primary target audience, and they're hearing all the breast cancer people. And breast, they've had a paradigm forever. You give them as much hormonal therapy as you can, and then you go to chemo. And then they come over here to prostate, and it's kind of a different paradigm. But anyhow, just pointing that out.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's keep going on because there's a lot of interesting data. This was Talipro 2 presented at ASCO, GU ASCO. Just as a reminder, there were several combo studies that looked at a PARP inhibitor plus an ARPI, in this case, talazoparib plus enzalutamide versus enzalutamide alone. Just as a reminder, this is first-line metastatic CRPC. And the primary endpoint was RPFS. But what was important here, and you can see it in the lower left-hand corner, is this was an unselected cohort. A subset of the patients had HRR mutations, but the others were either not deficient or unknown. And if you look at the primary endpoint, there was actually a significant benefit in all comers of unselected patients with RPFS. And you can see that 33 versus 19 months with a hazard ratio that favored the Tala group, 0.667. And more impressively and interestingly, the overall survival also favored the unselected group that received talazoparib with a 20% reduction in death. That's an 8-month median improvement in overall survival, which you can see in the bottom box there. Now, you know, one of the questions, of course, the immediate question is how much of this was driven by BRCA2, and are patients who are truly HRR or BRCA negative going to respond to talazoparib? And so they did do this kind of extra analysis of these patients who had both ctDNA and tumor tissue without any either BRCA alteration on the left or HRR alteration on the right. So they really were looking at what I might call a double negative. With both ctDNA and tumor tissue, they had no evidence of a BRCA alteration or an HRR alteration. And you can see that there was still an improvement in both groups in terms of survival. Now, you know, I think we know, if, and I'm not showing it here, but if you look at the BRCA2 group, it's a huge difference. And that's not a surprise. But this was one of those questions here is there activity of talazoparib in these non-HRR, non-BRCA patients? It was mostly driven by BRCA2, but this was statistically significant. And so the question has come up with this drug compared to some of the other PARP inhibitors that maybe there's a value to talazoparib plus enzalutamide in all patients with mCRPC, but we don't have a label such as that yet.
So just a couple of questions. We actually just came back from the SGO, Society of Gynecologic Oncology meeting. We did a program on ovarian cancer. And it's interesting there because one of the PARP inhibitors, niraparib, is actually approved in non-HRD patients, non-BRCA patients. But and that was a few years ago. They're going back and forth. But as of, you know, a few weeks ago, like, they're not too interested in it anymore. I mean, the benefit, maybe it's there. It kind of looks like this, but they're not really doing it. The question I wanted to ask you is, I know there are a lot of trials that are looking at PARP inhibition, particularly in BRCA patients in the endocrine-sensitive metastatic setting, what we were just talking about. I'm curious when you think we might see data on that. And in the interim, like, if your surgeon was BRCA2 germline, would you have considered or brought up the issue of in some way integrating, whether it's maintenance or, you know, whatever, and a PARP inhibitor?
Yeah. I take care of a lot of doctor patients, you know, because prostate cancer happens in older men, and they find me to talk about these pros and cons. I do think those studies have to be positive in HSPC when they're finally reported on. And I don't have a prediction on when the endpoints will be read out, but hopefully soon. Have I offered it or had that conversation with some of my patients who really understand the risk versus the benefits? Because these are not treatments that have no risk, right? They have some risk. They can cause anemia. They can cause a small risk of a bone marrow event. But I do think that they will turn out to be in patients with otherwise high-risk features, which many of them do present with, a significant benefit if they carry the BRCA2 alteration in particular. Would I do it in somebody who doesn't have a BRCA2 mutation, like a BRCA1 or ATM or CDK12 mutation? I probably wouldn't, but in a BRCA2 patient, I think pending the data, it's something that has come up in some of my patients.
I guess the other thing is going to be, and I don't know, I guess the trials, do they use like indefinite until progression PARP or for to find, you know, like in breast, they're adjuvantly, they use it just for a year, but metastatic, you know, it's until progression. But these patients may not progress for like, you know, a long time.
Yeah. It's I think in metastatic disease, this is the thing in prostate cancer. These patients are, you know, theoretically committed to lifelong treatment. And as we talked about earlier, I in my practice, don't always commit to that, depending on whether we have a biomarker, in this case, PSA, that tells us that the patients have gone back into remission. So it's a good question, and I think it's a risk over the long term, certainly even in the metastatic setting, because they are committed to the treatment for so long.
All right, let's move forward.
All right, so at ESMO this year, there was a surprising study, which is PEACE-3. This took a long time, was done, you know, really primarily in Europe. And you can see it was the radium versus plus enzalutamide versus enzalutamide in the frontline setting. And these were primarily patients who did not get enzalutamide or really any ARPI, and certainly they couldn't have had radium. And there were really several endpoints, but primarily PFS and subsequently OS. And what was interesting here is that RPFS was significantly better. You can see the hazard ratio 0.69, but interestingly, OS was better, and you can see the hazard ratio there also 0.69 with a p-value highly statistically significant, favoring the combo arm. The question here is, and these are some secondary endpoints, you can see time to next systemic treatment. Interestingly, time to skeletal events, which is what we tend to think of with a drug like radium, could be better, was actually not any better with radium, and neither was pain progression. So a lot of times we look at secondary endpoints, Neil, to try to see if the biology of the treatment makes sense. And radium, of course, is right now relegated mostly to third or fourth line in mCRPC. This surprising OS benefit, I think, got some attention. It was a plenary session at ESMO. The real problem, I'd say, in America is that almost all of our patients with MHSPC are already exposed to ARPIs. So this population were people who walked in with CRPC and had not ever received abiraterone or enzalutamide. So I think the question here is, does this apply to patients, for example, who had already received a prior ARPI like abiraterone, and so the question also is, you know, would we give radium in this setting versus, you know, chemotherapy or versus, if they were a PARP, if they were had a DDR mutation or if you believe TALAPRO2, should they get a PARP inhibitor? So there are more and more choices in this setting, and I think that's the question is whether this is a little bit too late to change practice. The interesting thing is it took so long to get this result, but here, you can see that the hazard ratio for survival with the addition of radium-223, and you see the lines cross here, so there may be some additional toxicities early on with radium, but it takes a while for these curves to separate, but they clearly separate. So not just PFS, but OS. The general consensus about radium was that it's kind of a rather weak drug. I've given it to many patients, and you don't see a PSA drop. You don't see a lot going on. And so this suggests that at least if you have bone-only disease and you give it early in CRPC, as long as the patients haven't already received an RP or radium, of course, that basically that they may benefit from this long-term. And my guess is that this will have a bigger effect outside of the U.S. than in the U.S. or in places where, for example, the patients really walk in with CRPC having been on ADT alone. But I think the general consensus is that it's hard to find patients like this. The other hot area, you know, radium was our first radiopharmaceutical, but of course, we're really moving into the LU-177 class of drugs, the beta particles tied to PSMA targeting. So SPLASH was an alternative to the LU-177 PSMA-617, which of course is commercially available right now. And this is PNT-2002. It's really the same molecule, but slightly less potent, and they used a slightly lower dose than they did in the VISION trial, for example. And this was in a second line setting. So they did not receive, this is really like more like PSMA-4, where they did not receive chemo. They only received a prior RP. And you can see the PFS was better, but pretty modest. It was 0.71. The p-value was significant. And you can also see the randomization compared to an alternate RP, that the CR rate was about 9%, the PR rate was about 28%. In the overall survival analysis, there was no difference in overall survival between the two groups. And if you look at the toxicity again, it's very similar to the slide I showed earlier. You can see that the toxicities were actually pretty low in the treatment arm compared to the alternate RP arm. There were really, again, fewer TEAEs and fewer serious TEAEs with PNT-2002. So it does show pre-chemo activity. I think the RPFS was compelling, but there was no OS benefit. And just like PSMA-4, this might be related to the fact that there was a high crossover rate. I do think this tolerability question is, you know, should we be giving lower doses of these drugs? Now, in general, I've found LU-177 PSMA-617 to be pretty well tolerated, but I think it'll be an interesting question about whether this alternate approach with a slightly lower dose would have a favorable longer-term outcome. And then the other place that you can take a PSMA radioligand is actually to earlier disease settings. So, of course, we're going to always think about patients who might be a candidate for PSMA radioligand therapy in the upfront metastatic setting. Just like we started the session with PSMA-directed therapies, these patients present with very hot PSMA PET scans. We're doing more and more of those. So this was an Australian study presented at ESMO, a phase 2 randomized design where they gave two cycles of docetaxel with LU-177 PSMA-617 versus the standard docetaxel. So everyone got a total of six cycles, but in the first two cycles, they got the 617 LU-177. And they used an interesting endpoint. They used undetectable PSA at 48 weeks. Remember I told you that I use that in my practice. So by 48 weeks, these guys are already done with their chemo. They're done with their LU-177. They only get two doses. And if you look at it, the hazard ratio for an undetectable PSA almost a year later was 3.88 in favor of the patients who got two cycles of LU-177. So it did meet its primary endpoint. It shows encouraging activity. We're waiting for some phase 3 studies, but one of the most interesting questions about this type of approach is, remember, when you put them on ADT and you put these patients on docetaxel, you're actually taking away the marker, PSMA. Like if you do a PSMA PET scan 6 months after they start or 3 months after they start docetaxel and ADT and an ARPI, the signal, PSMA signal is gone. So the question I think that's interesting is how many cycles of LU-177 should they get in this hormone sensitive setting when they're getting combinations? So it's an interesting study that suggests that there is some durable effect by just giving two cycles of LU-177. And then the last prostate study that I'm going to just talk about is CONTACT-2, presented again most recently at ESMO. And you can see here, the idea here was cabozantinib, which is a TKI, plus atezolizumab and IO versus a second novel hormonal therapy, an ARPI, in patients with mCRPC. These were very high-risk patients. We had a bunch of patients, you can see, with liver mets, and these were patients who might otherwise have benefited from treatments like chemotherapy. And the final OS was no different in the intent-to-treat population. This was a low bar, meaning that doing an ARPI switch in this high risk population, there was some criticism about that. But they did show some subsets that were, I think, of interest. You can see that the liver mets patients actually had an improvement in OS that favored the cabo plus atezo arm. I personally think that this might be a real finding. I think there's something biologically different about liver mets. Will they ever do a prospective trial in that group? I don't think so. We don't really know the contribution of atezolizumab. This could all be just a cabo-xantinib effect alone. And there's no comparison of cabo plus an IO versus an IO alone. So I think this general space is really not going to proceed forward. But I think we're still struggling in the prostate field with understanding whether there really is some value to immunotherapy. But those were the hottest studies in prostate cancer. So I can go on to renal. And a lot of the stuff in renal that we've seen at meetings is just longer term follow-up. And this is going to be familiar to the audience because basically, in both renal and bladder, I think there have been some practice-changing studies, but they're mostly now long-term follow-ups. And this is a good example of one of those. This is CheckMate 9ER and really led to Cabo-Nivo, speaking of Cabo, in the first-line treatment of clear cell renal carcinoma. And you can see the doses, this is pretty well known. And this control arm here was sunitinib, which was the previous standard of care. And you can see the long-term PFS in per Bicker in the ITT population and the OS, you can see there a hazard ratio of 0.79 in terms of overall survival. Now 5.5 years of follow-up, significantly in favor of Nivo-Cabo for first-line treatment of advanced renal cancer. A really significant duration of response, 22 months, and an overall response rate of about 55%. So I think, basically whenever you see longer-term follow-up, what you're looking for is that the established standard of care is still hanging in there. You can see in the PFS curves, you can see that the difference is maintained, even if in the OS curve you see them coming a little bit together with quite long follow-up. Continuing that mode, if Cabo plus Nivo is good, how about adding IPI, right? That's really the question here in COSMIC 313. So this was IPI-Nivo versus IPI-Nivo plus Cabo. With the idea that a TKI plus ipi-nivo would be better in clear cell renal carcinoma first line. And this did show a PFS benefit, as you can see on the left side. Hazard ratio was more modest, 0.82, but no difference in overall survival. And really, in addition, a doubling of treatment emergent adverse effects with significant stopping of at least one drug. So I think we already know that ipi-nivo is active in renal cell carcinoma, but with more toxicity. But if you try to add cabo to it, it's just, I think, it's not worth the risk, and you don't get an OS benefit compared to just ipi-nivo alone. There was an interesting translational study presented at ASCO GU here, which suggests that cabo may overcome these M2-like macrophages, which are immune suppressive. I think it is useful to see things like this because maybe we'll get biomarkers in the future that will help us to know who may benefit most from a drug like cabozantinib. Cabo is not without risk in terms of toxicity and how people feel. And there may be a subset here. We can see it in the PFS data that of patients who benefit from it. So I think, unfortunately, we're going away sometimes from biomarker-driven treatments because it's complicated. People don't want to have to do a test to see who benefits from the treatment. But But the truth is that probably not all patients benefit equally. And so you want to do, you want to see more of these translational studies to kind of find those subsets that might benefit. This next one is something that I think is familiar to people because we now have sub-Q Nevo approved by the FDA. But this was basically a poster at ESMO that gave an update on CheckMate 67T, which was really an equivalent study of sub-Q Nevo plus they use this enzyme, the pH20, that helps the Nevo to kind of dig in and stay in the skin versus IV Nevo. And if you look in kidney cancer with extended follow-up, the disease control rate was comparable. The toxicity profiles were also comparable. This is important. And basically, you don't want to switch from something that works to something that doesn't work just for the sake, for the convenience of sub-Q. But there was about a 7% local but low-grade injection site reactions. There's also a concern about whether you get anti-Nevo antibodies. And they are higher in sub-Q in the sub-Q arm, but that it seems to not have a clinical effect if you look at PFS. So I think there may be situations where sub-Q Nevo might have some greater benefit to the patient. I don't see it as being a tremendous value to patients who are now used to IV Nevo, but I think there may be some clinical scenarios in which that might be true. Tenevo 2 has been now presented, and this was a follow-up, but just as a reminder, this was the rationale with this approach was patients already received one or two lines of renal cancer therapy, including an IO. And the question is, if you give a second TKI with nivolumab versus divazinib alone, what would be the value of adding the combo versus just a TKI alone? And if you look at PFS, you see there's really no difference in PFS. And I think the question of rechallenge with an immune checkpoint inhibitor in somebody who's already progressed, even if you give them a break from the immune checkpoint inhibitor, that's answered in these two subsets here. You can see the second line and third line, it didn't matter. And if they got ICI as the most recent versus if they got something else in between, it didn't seem to make much difference. And the response rate was really from TiVo, which is a known active TKI, and no groups really benefited.
So just a quick follow-up to your review of IO papers. Just kind of curious what your favorite IO TKI combination is. I always like asking people that. You know, Tom Powles talks about the three identical twins or whatever. But how do you decide which one to use?
Yeah, I think Cabo-Nevo is really simple, straightforward, convincing, and has become my favored one. I think there are some patients for which Ipi-Nevo has some value, and I try to decide who should get Ipi-Nevo versus Cabo-Nevo. But it's pretty straightforward in my mind that the data that I just showed the updates for are well tolerated, you know, comfortable in my practice.
All right, please continue.
Well, this is an interesting drug. We just had the NCI director visiting us at Yale, giving a talk. She is a kidney cancer, Dr. Rathmel is a kidney cancer doctor, former NCI director, I should say. And she was talking about this drug, belzutifan, which is the first oral HIF-2 alpha inhibitor and has really dramatic responses, as we know, in VHL patients, who are rare. But it does also work really in patients with clear cell renal carcinoma. And this is the mechanism. It really blocks the driver of VEGF. And so this was a study, LightSpark-5, in patients who had already progressed after PD-L1 or PD-1 therapy plus a VEGF TKI, so really third line. And we have already seen prior results that suggest a PFS benefit of with a hazard ratio of 0.75 and an overall response that was also favored, about 20% respond. And so this is a long-term follow-up, and you can see as third-line therapy compared to everolimus, which was kind of the traditional third line treatment, you see the PFS benefit is persistent, hazard ratio 0.75, really identical to earlier reports. And I do think it's important to point out that the median duration of response in those 20% of patients who respond is 19 months. That's pretty significant, especially since mechanistically it's different from a typical TKI. And the side effects you can see here, you know, hypoxia, anemia, increased weight, some nausea. But I think what they show here is that if you're going to get one of these side effects, you get it really, really early. And you can, there are ways to obviously manage these, including, you know, pausing the drug and then rechallenging and giving supplemental oxygen if the patient needs it. But in general, I think it seems to be pretty well tolerated. Many of these side effects are mild. And then I'm going to end on bladder cancer. I think this was a big year for bladder cancer, mostly because of the Niagara study. This was obviously the most important perioperative study of the past few years, really. For many years, the standard of care for muscle-invasive bladder cancer, you know, clinical T2 to T4, N0, M0, it was in fact GEMSYS followed by radical cystectomy. So in this study, they randomized 1:1 to GEMSYS plus durvalumab for 4 cycles, and then they gave 8 cycles of adjuvant durvalumab. And the primary endpoints were event-free survival and pathologic complete response, with the secondary endpoint of overall survival. So this was presented at ESMO, and you can see the event-free survival here, significantly better, hazard ratio 0.68, p-value significant. But really, even more impressive is overall survival was already better even at this presentation with a hazard ratio 0.75. So, and I'm not showing it here, but all the subgroups seem to benefit. There was no unexpected toxicities. And in this neoadjuvant setting, you definitely don't want to delay surgery or have, you know, IO-related adverse events that would cause a problem with surgery, and that was not seen. So this was really a practice-changing phase 3 study. And then at ASCO GU, there were further data presented by Matt Galsky that showed metastasis-free survival reduced by 33%. Again, a high-risk population of patients who get local therapy but now have systemic benefit from the combo. There's an analysis that he showed that both patients who develop pathologic complete response, which is shown here, about 37 versus 27%, but also the non-pathologic complete response groups both benefited from perioperative durvalumab. And again, the side effects were well understood and certainly reasonable. So practice changing, patients should be getting this unless there's a contraindication to IO, not just GEMSYS as neoadjuvant therapy. So there are adjuvant studies, of course, CheckMate 274, which has been seen before in terms of nivolumab versus placebo in high-risk patients who have muscle-invasive urothelial cancer, who had already had a neoadjuvant chemotherapy, as well as those without prior neoadjuvant chemotherapy. And they got up to 1 year of adjuvant nevo. And you can see that DFS was significantly improved, whether or not they had neoadjuvant chemo. And the OS, the survival here is 0.70, again favoring nevo, and PD-L1 status, as it, and many other studies, didn't seem to make a difference. So practice changing adjuvant nevo as an option if you're not going to give neoadjuvant durvalumab in addition to chemo. And the Ambassador study, which is a cooperative group trial, looked at pembro in a very similar design to the prior one, DFS, and as the primary endpoint. You can see, again, pembro is also quite active, hazard ratio 0.73, p-value very significant. This was presented by Dr. Apollo at ESMO. And pretty long follow-up, 45 months. And again, PD-L1 was not a predictor, neither was lymph node status. But because of the FDA approval of nevo as adjuvant therapy, this study did close early. So the theme of these studies is either neoadjuvant or adjuvant IO in muscle-invasive urothelial cancer should become the standard of care. And then the final kind of interesting localized question was TAR-200. I just put the picture of what TAR-200 is. It's kind of this little pretzel-shaped device that urologists can put into the bladder that's infused with gemcitabine. So it's a better way to give intravesical therapy. Right now, these are the options for what you can do for patients with non-muscle invasive bladder cancer with BCG unresponsive in situ carcinoma. Now, most oncologists don't see these patients, although they may be seeing them more because these are all, basically oncology type drugs. But you can see the response rates are fairly modest, 19, 23, 25, 45%. But the Sunrise study is looking at TAR-200 either as monotherapy, which is in red, or as in combination with a PD-1 inhibitor or the PD-1 inhibitor alone. And you can see that the best response was actually the monotherapy, suggesting that you do not need to give PD-1 therapy either in combination or as monotherapy in patients. And I remember the response rate that I showed earlier were all in the 20, 40% range. So here we're seeing an 83% response rate. And my last slide is just, again, a follow-up of what we know. This is Tom Powell's presented at GU-ASCO, the longer-term follow-up EV-302, which is now the standard of care for metastatic urothelial cancer. And we know EV-Pembro has become the standard of care compared to chemotherapy based on this trial. PFS and OS were the primary endpoints. And now with longer follow-up, with one additional year follow-up, you can see a hazard ratio of 0.48 in terms of PFS by Bicker. But even more impressively, overall survival, 0.51. So all patients with metastatic urothelial cancer really should be getting EV Pembro as the first-line therapy unless there's a specific contraindication. It's so much superior to what we've had in the past.
So final question is, any more thoughts about Niagara and how you see that playing out in clinical practice?
Yeah, I mean, I think we've had for historically difficulty getting the patients to get neoadjuvant therapy at all, right?
Really?
Well, I mean, I think it's some patients still don't get referred for chemotherapy unless you're in a center of excellence. Most of these patients should be, obviously a lot of your audience are in the community. And I think the question is, where do they go when they get muscle invasive bladder cancer? And there are some patients who still do not get neoadjuvant chemotherapy, Neil, and they go straight to, cystectomy. And in that setting, obviously, there are options for adjuvant IO. But do I think all patients should get IO plus chemo as a neoadjuvant followed by durvalumab? I think that is the new standard of care. And so I think your question is Niagara the way we should be considering treating most of these patients? And I think if they're candidates for cystectomy, the answer is yes.
Any thoughts about how to more effectively get the message out to urologists?
Bladder cancer is still relatively rare and uncommon for muscle-invasive patients. There's a lot of superficial bladder cancer out there. It's kind of a bread and butter for urologists. I think the question always becomes, when do they refer them into a center of excellence for the cystectomy? And when do they get their oncology colleagues to start the neoadjuvant chemo and now add durvalumab to those patients? I think it's a good topic because it's so important to do a multidisciplinary approach. And I hope that most patients out there are getting that combo of the neoadjuvant therapy followed by definitive local treatment with surgery.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. O, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Today, the implications of recent data sets for the current and future management of genitourinary cancers.